No, I think we're all caught up, Bob.
Okay.
Let the class begin.
All right. Yes, let the class begin. I'm going to go through my greatest hits that I found, and they're not in any particular order, but I'll just start at the top and we'll see what we come up with. So the very first thing, it's called 1972 Trip. So this is probably when he goes to the Mediterranean and a Greek architect named Doxiadis, D-O-X-I-A-D-I-S, Mr. Doxiadis, who ran Echistix magazine, Echistix. Every year he would have the elite thinkers of the world get on his boat and cruise around the Mediterranean. So McClune first did it in like 63, and then he never got back. He kept being invited back, but he never could make it back because he got distracted by things that once he was famous, everybody wanted him to be with them. So he didn't get back till 1972. Didn't get back to do the cruise again 9 years later. So he writes a letter to friends of his in Toronto about the trip. So let's see what he says. So this is dated August 1st, 1972. So he goes to Dublin first, to an Irish setup, and then to Paris, and then to Athens and Delos. They go to the Temple of Delos. So it says, he says to his friends, "Dear Tom and Dorothy, Corinne and I have had quite a lot of flitting about. First to Dublin, then to Paris, then to Athens and Delos, and now home for the rest of the summer, we hope. You have probably heard from Jane about our recent muggy hot spell. Corinne and I got bad cases of bronchitis in Dublin and carried this bug throughout our trip. In spite of this, Dublin was an unexpected joy. We met wonderful people there and had a chance to feel the quality of life." Now, he's very interested in the oral culture of Dublin, right? "There being no industry to speak of, the city is still dominated by people and their pleasure in visiting and chatting during the working day," working in clothes, in quotes. "The Americans are buying up the rural areas in Ireland for speculative reasons. At present, one of these reasons is stud farming. We were entertained by Mr. and Mrs. McHenry, who are in that business themselves, having a very large ranch on the outskirts of Dublin itself. He is an Irishman who made a fortune in Wall Street. He became a fan of my Dooline newsletter, and that is how we made our contact. Bob O'Driscoll of St. Mike's English Department," O'Driscoll's the Irish scholar who goes nuts later in Toronto and runs back to Ireland and dies. "Bob O'Driscoll of St. Mike's English Department is doing a sabbatical in Dublin to work on Yeats and Irish theater. He has rented a large house beside James Joyce's Martello Tower," so it's the house right beside the opening scene in the Ulysses novel, "and gives large parties. He gave one for us that went on until 5 a.m., although I remember that we got away somewhat before then. So it went on to 5 a.m., although I remember that we got away somehow before then. Or, yes, somewhat before then. In Dublin, I had to give some lectures both on radio and TV and in public, and these turned out quite well. In Paris, there were no lectures but some TV appearances." Now, that would be the one, Roxy, with Pierre, whatever his name is. Remember, he's joking with Pierre, and Pierre is very serious.
Again, the what?
The guy you studied, Pierre somebody, in Paris, the intellectual, and McLuhan is dialoguing with him and being translated by Derek de Kirchhoff, and you see this sort of playful look on McLuhan's face while Pierre gets confused by McLuhan. You know, you studied
Pierre.
You
mean Pierre Schaeffer?
Yes. He's a music scholar or something.
Yeah, he's
right?
One of the main popes of electronic music in France,
right,
in the world.
Right. And now
he
remember?
He started, like, working with what we now call samples.
Yes,
with the
samples,
recording
yeah.
noises and things like that.
All right, so who's causing the echo? Who did we say it was last time? Ginny. She's not here. So I'm going to mute a few people for a minute. Hello. Okay, so if I go, hello. Well, it's gone. All right. Okay, so in Paris, he did a few TV appearances, and one of them was the funny one he did with Pierre. Remember that? We were laughing at it. Pierre was very serious, and he didn't like McLuhan.
Pierre Schaeffer said, we are mystics. And he said, no, well, I'm not a mystic. He knows the real meaning of the word. So he says, no, that's not a mystic.
Yeah, so in Paris, says McLuhan, there were no lectures but some TV appearances which were complicated by my inadequate French. Do you remember Derek had to translate them? Complicated, he says, by my inadequate French. Paris is a lot like Dublin in that the people insist on keeping the human qualities uppermost, rigorously suppressing any temptations, plural, to be efficient or punctual. The result is that at all hours of the day and night, there are endless conversations in progress in restaurants and cafes. In one of these, we met Professor Duvignaud. That's D-U-V-I-G-N-A-U-D. You know that name? I've seen that name before. Anyways, in one of these, we met Professor Duvignaud, who is a keen media man teaching this under the guise of the sociology of art. So he's teaching media under the guise of the sociology of art at the University of Tours, T-O-U-R-S. McLuhan's daughter, Terry McLuhan, is in Paris a good deal, and he took us all to visit a friend of his, the dramatist Ionesco, the famous playwright Ionesco. And McLuhan writes Open from Cliché to Archetype in 1970 with an interpretation of Ionesco's play called The Bald Soprano. But he met him a couple years later. It was in the evening, and Ionesco explained that he had to go to see the second part of his new play, Macbeth, M-A-C-B-E-T-T, in brackets, a parody of Power on the theme of Macbeth, M-A-C-B-E-T-H, Shakespeare's play. I boldly suggested that we might be allowed to accompany him, and he was delighted. We got there just at the intermission and were able to see the last part of the play with him. It won't have its premiere in English for some months. It is a delightful spoof of Power antics. After all, Macbeth was a hijacker too. See, McLuhan in 71-72 is talking about the new fad of hijacking. And he's talking about the hijacking of cities, planets, and... cities, nations, and planets. So he then projects his hijacking interest of his onto Macbeth. After all, Macbeth was a hijacker too. Unfortunately, the second page of the letter I don't have. It's somewhere in the mixture of the 13,000 items. I haven't been able to find the second half. But that was the first letter there for you. Any comments?
Yeah, Bob, he had identified Shakespeare as a hijacker. So Shakespeare is considered high culture and high reading by... literate book people as a must-know for Western civilization. But I remember reading and hearing that McLuhan thought Shakespeare was lowbrow, right? He had been...
Yes.
It was lowbrow. It was disgusting humor at the time, kind of a lewd, bald humor. It made fun of, and the actors that they used at the time were just bit players that weren't well-known or had kind of taken themselves down to the lowest denominator to be in Shakespeare's plays at the time. It wasn't considered high art. It was lowbrow. And then McLuhan flips it later of Shakespeare's considered high art form and a must-know amongst literate people. But he identified Shakespeare as a hijacker of culture at the time.
All right. Yeah, but he's saying, after all, Macbeth was a hijacker, so he did a play about hijackers. It could include him, because if you read LaRouche, Shakespeare was on the Catholic faction, having a serious civil war with the Protestants. And a lot of the later dark tragedies are a result of Shakespeare responding to the post-Elizabethan the First Elizabeth I reign. Like the Catholics.
Bob, was it ever
out.
Right? Was it ever proven that Bacon, Sir Francis Bacon, was Shakespeare, or were they separate entities? What does your research shows? Because I'd heard a lot of kind of esoteric talk that Bacon was Shakespeare and was writing under a pseudonym. But what's your take on that?
Well, I could find it somewhere, but it'll take a while. But I asked the Evergreens, and the Evergreens said that Shakespeare wrote the plays, and then Bacon, a few years later, I guess after Shakespeare died, Bacon, he was a big, heavy guy. I mean, Chancellor of the Exchequer, you know, right at the top of British society. He got the, I guess, Shakespeare portfolio, and he put his experience in it, the political intrigue of his level of society. So he edited and did things to it, which always puzzled people, said the Evergreens, because they didn't know how Shakespeare, this bumpkin, you know, in London, how he understood the intrigue and higher politics. Well, that's because it was written, that part was added by Bacon.
So he kind of is a ghostwriter for the real Shakespeare, or the authentic one, and then he added his own.
Not a ghostwriter. Shakespeare. What? Shakespeare wrote the plays, and they were knockoffs.
Okay.
He's like Zappa. Shakespeare's a lot like Zappa, you know, appeared to be in the vulgar world, but, you know, very sophisticated stuff. I don't know how sophisticated Shakespeare was, but he was playing pop culture back to the people, and he was really good at it. I can't remember what Devery said. He was really good at something, telling a story or whatever theater required.
And then Bacon capitalized on his success.
No, Bacon just took the fucking stuff, real simple, and he rewrote it. No, he didn't rewrite it. He added whatever sophistication, and he was a philosopher, and his own personal experiences high up in the British society, he put that in there somehow, added lines, I guess, added ideas. So it's a combination of both.
Did those two have a relationship? Did they have a relationship where he would be allowed access to Shakespeare?
I didn't find that out. I didn't ask the Evergreens that, how he got the information.
I would like to make a comment.
Yes.
I think this encounter with McLuhan would have been very interesting, because I read that UNESCO developed his style because he was studying English, and he was learning these phrases that you say.
Yes,
constructions.
Yeah.
And he saw that most people communicate with this type of phrases. They don't really use any creativity. They just use these formulas, and at the end, were really saying nothing.
Right.
It's not real thought, real creativity. So he was showing that in his absurd plays.
Yeah.
And I suppose for Marshall McLuhan would have been very interesting because of that. And also James Joyce, and now I've been reading Nostradamus in French. And he's like James Joyce. He goes into such mastery of the French language that at the time was like a new language, like maybe like Shakespeare in English or Cervantes in Spanish. These languages were being developed, and he does everything to the words to cultivate all types of information there. The way they do this, like James Joyce or Nostradamus, is so complex that that's why I think it's beyond human. I think they were not aware of all the levels of things they were putting into what they were writing.
Right.
It's really iron, like I said, putting things.
It was much ado
everywhere
about nothing.
The non-physical put in important stuff.
Right, and they disguised it as vulgary humor and low.
No, they didn't. The writers didn't know it was being put in there. This is what he said about Finney's Wake. There's three cycles that Joyce created, but there's a fourth cycle, non-physical, put in that Joyce wasn't aware of.
Were they channeling?
Yes, and the magic of Nostradamus is that sometimes after the events, people see very clearly that it was in his centurias, that these things were written, but not before. So that's something that is really fascinating with the way he wrote these things.
Right.
There's something esoteric about them. Were they like channeling non-physical in their words? They got influenced by non-physical when they're writing. They
Maybe.
Weren't aware of it. And it shows up later in the writing when you look at the patterns that, they nailed some event, or they precognitive of what would happen, or they named a new metaphor. Like they were open to the influence of non-physical because of their status or position. Some of them were, into alchemy, like Bacon and Shakespeare, or that they were influenceable, able to be influenced by something non-physical, and that's what made them artists and writers at the time.
Well, how about this? How about they just change the words in the manuscript?
Like they rearranged it, like a gematria of...
They added words.
Gematria. And they
added
the value of the...
You also experienced that when you were doing your chart. Like I said, the angels were helping you.
Yes.
And you
did
these things, and maybe you were not aware of all the things that you were putting really into the chart.
Right.
I agree. They were inspired.
You are still discovering things.
They were able to be inspired, influenced, and that's what made them special or artist or unique, that they were open to the non-physical channel. Angels could talk to them, could come through their words and pens, but they weren't aware of it.
That may be true, Brian, but I'm saying consider the fact that they didn't know that iron or non-physical came in and changed the words. Maybe after they were written, like the portfolio, when Bacon did it, Shakespeare's gone, and they altered it, and Bacon did or didn't notice it.
It's like the Mandela effect.
Like the Mandela effect, exactly, Roxy. You took it out of my mouth. It changed later, like Berenstain-Bittner's Mandela effect of words.
Right. See, you're thinking of non-physical being over there somewheres and has to come through a channeling thing to affect physical. Ion says, no, they can affect... And I don't know if this is since 2009, but they can affect computers and our world. They can alter things. They can stop things.
Or old, like the Berenstain Bears Mandela effect of altering books that have already been printed, and then we go back later and look at them, and there's been changes.
Yeah.
But like a glitch in the Matrix later.
Right. Yep. That could be what it was. Okay, I'm looking up in McLuhan's, one of the biographies about Ionesco. Let's see what details they have in this book. This is the second biography written later by Terence Gordon. And... I was looking in the Phil Marchand, the first book that came out in 1989, and no Ionesco story in there. But in this second one, which comes out about 1997, Ionesco...
You researched McLuhan so much. Was he conflicted about his personal beliefs with the Catholic Church? He made profound insights into media culture.